4632, Kitty Hart Moxon, reel 13, followed by a shortish reel 14 after a pause. Left channel is informant mic only, right channel informant plus interviewer.
Kitty Hart Moxon, reel 13.
Well, we're coming to the mid 70s, which is a very busy period for me because my boys were growing up and conditions in my household were quite difficult with having to pay the mortgage. Oh, I must go back to one thing, and that was when I was pregnant, we were still living in one room in a very sort of precarious house. Leaking roof, and I realised nowhere could I have a baby there. And somehow or other, we had to buy a house, and we needed desperately money for a deposit. And the deposit for the house came from Jane Leveson. She actually sent me the money to put down the deposit, which was a loan, and which we said we were going to repay, and which we repaid like a mortgage, you know, every month. I used to send out this printed sum of money to repay, which was a lot of money in those days, £400. It seemed a lot of money in the 1950s. The whole house cost £2,000, so £400 was a huge sum of money, which we were repaying every month. And then when my second son was born, Jane wrote back she didn't want any more repayments because this was a present for my other son, that was Jane Leveson. Yeah. I just felt I had to tell you this. So things were quite difficult because Ralph was working part-time, trying to build up a business. I used to take the children out and try and get some orders for him. In the prams, I used to take them and get these orders to try and establish him. And at the same time, I was working full-time in different hospitals at different times. And I didn't like to work full-time because I had to be at home as well, to see to the children. My mother was living with me at the time, of course. I didn't explain that when I realised my mother could no longer really work for somebody else and her health wasn't all that good at that time, I approached my uncle to see if he could possibly help me support my mother, because in those days, you know, I still didn't have enough money to support the household, the mortgage. At times there wasn't enough food in the house and enough fuel to heat the house, because we were very, very short of money. But he couldn't help me in those days, and so I still had my mother to support. And anyway, she came to live with us, and of course that was enormous help, because I could actually go out to work and she'd help to run the household and do some cooking and look after the children when I was at work.
Had you had any compensation?
Oh yes, compensation came much later, late 60s. That came very, very late. We did apply for compensation. We applied, my mother applied for loss of her husband, her own loss of earnings, imprisonment. I tried to apply for loss of education, which they wouldn't allow me because they said I didn't go to a German school. So eventually it came, but of course by that time, there were desperate 10 years before that happened. Eventually my mother, yes, she got her compensation, she got pension, and in fact most of her pension was handed over to me to help me run the household, because I didn't get compensation much, much later. You know, they wouldn't accept me, and I didn't have a particular disease to show for it, fortunately and unfortunately, because, you know, so eventually I got it on mental grounds, on mental damage to mental health or something like this, but they wouldn't accept it, and they wouldn't even accept the hole in my head, and I had a lot of back trouble because I had a lot of beatings on my spine, and I had a lot of spinal problems. But these were too trivial to receive compensation. Eventually I did get a compensation. I'm still receiving a small pension. It helped enormously, because it didn't help to keep the household going, but my mother had some substantial sums of compensation at that time, so much so that we managed in the end to pay off, we managed to sell the first house, the small house, move into a larger house, because we were very, very cramped in a tiny little house. And my mother paid for the whole house, the compensation paid for the house, and most of her money, because we kept her all these years, and eventually she repaid over and over, because she, you know, she said, well, that's the money I want to spend on this. She just gave me the money to spend on what I felt was needed. And we're now going to the late 60s. By that time I bought one property. I really wanted to establish Ralph in the business, you know, but you couldn't get through to him that was the way forward, you know, to have a shop and perhaps sell some antiques and do them up, and you know, but no, he was just content to mail away then, he didn't want to know. So I knew I was wasting my time. I decided I've got to do something with this money to bring in some income. So I bought an old property which I converted into bedsitters, and I let it out to students, and it didn't make an awful lot of money, but it did make an enormous difference to just bring some extra money into the household. Now we're going into the 70s. By that time I was working flat out all over the place, because my husband wasn't doing all that well, and you can't do anything with a one-man business, and you can't possibly do anything. He didn't want to, he wouldn't employ anyone, you know, to help him out and to expand. I wasn't prepared to work in a shop. You know, by that time I was quite happy working in different hospitals, and I was sort of freelancing in different places. I didn't make any money from my books, but I was very busy with different projects. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and by that time I was already asked, would I come and speak to certain groups, like people ring up now, or would I come and talk in a small way, I think, not as it is mm-hmm. today, of course.
What was the Jewish community becoming more sort of open and interested?
No, I didn't have any response from the Jewish community, not until, I think, after I returned to Auschwitz. That was a catalyst, in fact.
This was your television. Mm. Could you tell me about that?
Well, we come to about the late 70s, when there was this particular program, the Holocaust program, and there was also a program, Tanya Fenlon's program, a musician of Auschwitz. They did a program there, very, very badly produced programs, and this man, Peter Morley, who's had a very distinguished career, but I think he was also a refugee, but he'd been over many, many years. I think they must have come over very early, early 30s, because he no longer had an accent. He went to school in England. He, at one time, was had something, he was, I don't know, was he the bodyguard of Churchill or something? He had some connection with Churchill, and he was also one of the first people who walked into Berlin with the British Army, and he'd been decorated, and he'd made all kinds of documentaries. He made the Jubilee, there was a film made on the Queen, yes, Jubilee, yes. So he had a very distinguished career, but he was absolutely horrified with this Holocaust program, and he searched desperately to do a proper documentary, not only about Auschwitz, but about women at war. That was his theme, actually, women at war. And I think that's when he came to Martin Gilbert. And Martin, at that time, had written his first book, I think, The Last Journey, I think it was, something like that. And he was, again, researching for more work. And, of course, he picked up my book, I think. You know, picked up all the testimonies. And he handed this to Peter Morley, and they came to me, and they had interviewed quite a lot of people at that time, and I said, yes, I would like to do a documentary, but there's only one way to do it. Only one way. If you want me to do it, I must go back to Auschwitz. I said, what? Oh my that. We must be able to do a documentary without going back to Russia. I said, no, that's the only way I think it can be done. If you want me, I insist on going back. He said, well, we actually want to do a half-hour program. And it would be within a series of women at war. There were about five women they interviewed for different, they had different experiences, and they were all people that had done something extraordinary. I said, well, I haven't done anything extraordinary. I survived, but I'm not some hero or anything like that. You know, I don't fit into your category whatsoever. Also, if you want to do a documentary with me, it couldn't possibly be done in half an hour. If you think you could do it in 2 hours, possibly, but in half an hour, I just am not interested to do that. But if you feel you want me to do it, I'd go back to the camp. Oh, he said, we couldn't let you go on your own. I said, but it doesn't matter. I've got a son who's a doctor, he's qualified, and at the moment, he happens to be in Canada. My younger son, I wouldn't like him to go because he was working for British Aerospace. He signed the Official Secrets Act. He was working on some nuclear warhead for the Ministry of Defence. I said, we couldn't let him go behind the Iron Curtain. He'd been vetted and all that, and no. But my older son, he was just at the moment in Canada. If you like, I'll phone him. I picked up the telephone just then, and he said, yes, do that. I picked up the telephone and then and there put a call through to Saskatchewan, because that's where he was. And it happened to be 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, oh yes. He said, what is it? I said, David, do you want to go to Auschwitz? Oh yes, he said, please, can I come tomorrow? And so I put the receiver down and I said to Peter Morley, there you are, speak to him yourself, he wants to go. That's something he very much wants to do by that time, that learned more about what happened, and although we didn't talk about it, but he was always interested to really go back to his mother's roots, sort of, and he wanted to go back. But my mother would never let me go back, actually. While she was alive, she said, I don't want you ever to go back. So I knew that, I couldn't do anything at all while my mother was alive. When my mother died in 1974. Well, this actually came about 1978, I think it was early 78 or 77. Well, eventually they decided, yes, all right, we go back. He said, well, what shall we call this program if we decide to make this? I said, call it Return to Auschwitz. And that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And we made the program. Mm-hmm. And
what's it like for you going back?
Oh, it was incredible. Because when I stepped back, and Peter Morley says that, I became a changed person. He said, you were not the same person I knew. I felt that I'd never been away. That was the first thing that hit me. Although the place looked different because it was all grassed over, it was all green. And I remembered it all muddy and, swampy and full of people, and this was empty. But I didn't see the emptiness. I saw all these people. And so I seem to have transformed to a prisoner. My old personality, he said, transformed.
Did you feel at home? Did you feel at home?
Yes. Yeah. I felt I'd never been away. In fact, if it hadn't been for this taxi that kept on fetching me back, I kept thinking, well, I can't get out of here. How am I going to get out of it? I saw the gate, it was open, and I thought, no, surely I've not been away from here, have I? It was a most odd transformation, because I knew I was going to go back, because I was interviewed, how do I feel about going back, and I said then, I don't know if I'm psychologically prepared to go back, not as psychologically prepared as I was when I first got in, but I feel I have to go back, even if I don't want to go back, mm-hmm. And no one actually had been back, none of the survivors had been back. It was kind of the beginning of things. And when the program actually came out, I think it stunned everybody, because nobody actually seen life in a camp like this before. And I had these thousands and thousands of letters, and it somehow started things off. And after that, of course, I was asked to write the Return to Auschwitz, to rewrite the book, which I attempted to do, not very well, but there it is. And
did you find, though, going back and having the freedom of the place, as it were, that it was a, that you were surprised. I mean, was there anything that surprised you about Auschwitz?
There's a lot of things surprised me if you hadn't seen before. I mean, I was dumped, for instance, the film crew dumped me in a certain place and I didn't know where I was. You know, I said, this is Birkenau, but I've never been in this section. I don't know where I am. You know, I was totally disorientated. I had to find the landmarks. I had to find, you know, the places where I was. And things that surprised me, for how many caps there were, which I didn't know. I didn't realise how vast the place was. No, not until I actually got back and had the run of the place. Because it was so far to walk from one place to the other.
Well, what did you think of the way it had been retained? You know, that what the Poles had kept of Auschwitz.
Well, of course, in 78, it was relatively unspoiled. It was pretty well left to disintegrate, I would say, because a lot of it had disintegrated, it hadn't been renovated. So I felt that's how it should stay. Let it disintegrate. But of course, they had to preserve some of the wooden huts. Now, they were rotting away, so I realised one or two huts had to be preserved to show what at least they looked like, because most of the huts turned disintegrated, and all that was left were the heating channel that was visible, nothing else. You could see these like little chimneys sticking out. There was nothing else. The whole place, of course, was overgrown with grass. That didn't ring true, naturally, but they couldn't do anything about that. But they left the watchtowers, they left the electric fencing. Of course, the crematoria had been blown up, and that was a surprise to me, because I only remember one crematorium having been destroyed during the uprising, although I read afterwards that they had destroyed the other crematoria, but I hadn't actually seen them destroyed. And, of course, I hadn't been inside the gas chamber, which I managed to go inside and see. It was quite dangerous. Some of the ruins you knew were actually out of bounds. And there were one or two places like that surprised me. On the other hand, one or two places were left completely intact, and I had to clamber over stuff to go inside, and found that rubbish had been just swept onto one side, and you could pick up still prisoner belongings there, which hadn't been touched. But having been back since, I was back in 1992, I think I made a program where four neo-Nazis were taken back, and I was supposed to take these neo-Nazis around the camp. They actually walked out on me eventually, unfortunately, I must say. So we couldn't continue the program the way we wanted to, and I was actually shocked by some of the reconstruction that was going on. You see, I, in 1978, still found the pits, the original pits where people were being, the bodies were being burned, or even people were being burned, and I found the ash, and I found ponds where the ash was deposited. The pits were difficult to find because they were overgrown, but I knew where they were located. So I didn't have it all that much difficulty in locating the places. And when we were back in 1992 or 93, I couldn't find anything. It had been crossed over, and they had white crosses everywhere, manicured, and like sort of a memorial, and white stars of David everywhere. And it just, I was shattered to see this. And some parts where they laid new concrete on the original platform, which could have been left as it was, which wasn't particularly good, because it was disintegrating even during the war, while the camp was in existence. There was no need to have done anything to that. They attempted to put mortar, new mortar, in places which was visible. On the other hand, they were not very good at preserving the mountains of clothes and shoes, which was actually rotting behind the glass enclosures, because they had no experience of how to preserve things in the museum. Whereas if you think about the museum, you have leather and whatever, which is centuries old, and their stuff was getting mouldy and not being properly preserved. So I wasn't very happy about that. That was by 1992. till 93. Then in 1978 I was very impressed with the work that was being done. I was also impressed by many of the former prisoners who took it upon themselves to be guards and come and work in the archives and work in the offices there, and put the records together and write books and write things up, and actually lived outside the perimeter of the camp and helped to look after the camp. So I was very impressed with that. And I was impressed by the amount of visiting from the Eastern Bloc that was there at the time in the 70s, where they were saying there were no visitors from the West, whatever. And I think we were one of the first people who had permission to actually do this programme. I don't recall that they allowed any prior filming in the camp until Peter Morley applied. They had to apply, Yorkshire Television actually had to apply to the government for permission. Mm. And so we were permitted to film the area.
What is your sort of opinion of the Imperial War Museum founding a genocide department, which of course will house a Holocaust?
Well, of course I've been waiting 50 years for something like this to happen. My whole post-war life I've been hoping, and I've been on various committees where even the Board of Deputies were hoping to establish a museum. But there was always a stumbling block, and the stumbling block were funds. No one ever found enough funds to be able to have a museum. The only thing they managed to do was a memorial stone in Hyde Park. I was actually disgusted with that. I mean, we were allocated a site for a memorial, and just to put up a stone, I didn't think what that was to represent. I was hoping that there would be a nationwide Jewish fundraising campaign, as they're fundraising all the time for the Israelis. They should have been fundraising to establish a museum in this country, just like they have done in the States, and they've done quite a few. There are quite a few museums in apart from the Washington Museum. There are other centres that have been established. Whereas here, it was impossible because the funds were not available. And without funds, it just wasn't possible. So this was something that I've been hoping for years and years and years. And I attempted to. I've had lots and lots of books, as you see. My whole room is full of Holocaust books. I mean, not just here, it's also downstairs. And everything is related to the wartime period, which I've been collecting. The books come out, I buy them, I have them sent to me. There was a historian in a teacher's training college in Hull who specialised in the Holocaust in the teacher's training college, and I did some projects with him. I did quite a lot of projects since 1978. I've been doing projects nearly every week, and that was one of the projects I did in Hull. And this, we did videotapes as well, how to help to teach the Holocaust, not only how what happened, but how to actually try and teach it. And that was already in the late 70s. And unfortunately, he died. First of all, they closed his department, the teacher's training, the history department. And then they closed the whole college, the teacher's training college. It became a polytechnic or some such thing. Anyway, he died, and his wife sent me all of his collection of books. I had an enormous amount of books. Many of these have now gone to Beth Shalom. I've given them to Stephen. And I offered these to the City of Berlin Library. I said, if you can make a Holocaust section, I can give you a lot of material. But I'm afraid the response was, we can't do this. We can put them into the whole of the history, if you like, but we cannot separate them and make a Holocaust section. Oh, I said, no, in that case, no, let's forget it. And there were many, many projects like this that we were involved, but we couldn't proceed. At one time, we brought an Auschwitz exhibition from Poland, from the museum, in the early 80s. We wanted to stage an exhibition here. It was a travelling Auschwitz exhibition. It was brought over at great cost, actually. We had managed to raise funds to bring this over. The Poles let it out. We housed it in a place, in a warehouse here. Somebody actually housed it for us. And we couldn't get permission to mount this exhibition in the whole of the city of Berlin. They wouldn't have it. The Jewish community wouldn't have it. They were afraid to have it. Yes, there was an excuse for security. In the end, we did manage to bring this exhibition and to actually have this exhibition, and it was held by a very kind permission of the Bishop of Stepney, Jimmy Thompson, in the East End of London. And we had it in the crypt, and it was one of the very first exhibitions, Auschwitz exhibition, well before the Anfrank World Exhibition. And it was very successful. We had schools, and there was no question of security. It was perfectly safe in the crypt. The stuff was eventually housed back here in Birmingham. The National Front got to know about it. They got in and they set fire to it. Yes, they set fire to it. And we lost a lot of documentation, and there was, you know, human hair, there were uniforms, you know, prisoners. Close, there's a lot of valuable stuff that was actually lost. And the historian came over, and of course the government insisted, the Polish government, on having this returned. Now they offered this. If there could have been a permanent place for it, they offered it all. And we could have had it all. Yes.
Did you think of the Imperial War Museum?
I must confess I did not think of the Imperial War Museum at the time.
I'm sure they would have had it.
Well, they might have. I don't think they would have had it at that time. I'll tell you, because I visited the Imperial War Museum at one stage and I was horrified. There was only just a tiny little corner, a few pictures of Belsen or whatever, and there was hardly anything. And I went with Philip one time to look at this, and we said, well, they can't be very interested to have it, because you know, if they had been interested, I'm sure they would have also perhaps housed the Auschwitz exhibition. But in those days, people are afraid to have it, because there was this National Front was quite strong here, really. And I think it was a question of security. It was just the courage that the Bishop of Stepney had to have it in the crypt. Perhaps they would have had it in the museum.
How important do you think the oral accounts are in sort of remembering the Holocaust, you know, for future generations?
Well, I think the oral history is a marvellous project. I think, I'm sorry that we didn't have an oral history 50 years ago, of course, because we'd lost so many people that could have contributed so much. And I think if people hadn't actually been talking about it over the years, it must be quite difficult to start at this stage. And many of them don't want to talk about it. And I talk about it, and I have a feeling that this friend of mine that committed suicide had something to do with it. I mean, people won't say so, but I have a feeling that she never did want to talk about it. There are certain things that she didn't want to talk about. She had a privileged position, and I think that guilt feeling that you have if that, you know, if you were in this sort of situation, you didn't want to talk about it. There were a lot of pressures on her to stop talking about it. I don't know whether that had contributed to the fact that at this stage she committed suicide. No. Well, it has never been particularly difficult for me to talk about it, because I have done so many projects over the last past 50 years, and been schools and television interviews, and I've done projects with films, with Sophie's Choice, and I've never found it difficult to talk about it. In fact, because I haven't been able to speak to anyone for years and years, and it was sort of all within me, it was almost a relief to be able to talk about it to people who are really prepared to listen. But that, of course, isn't the case with everyone, and some people will find it very difficult. I know in my book I did say it was a worthwhile experience, something like that I said. And I must say I expressed myself very badly there, and it has been misunderstood, actually. But what I really meant to say is that if it had to happen, Well, it's just as well it happened to me, because it's taught me so much about life. And it was a terrible thing to go through. But looking back, I'm glad it happened to me. Possibly because of what it taught me about life in general, about human nature. You know everything about human nature. You know how to categorize people, you know, you put them into compartments. If you talk to people for 5 minutes, you know exactly what they're going to think. You know how they would react to a certain situation, sort of. You know, you can work that out pretty quickly. You know how they would behave when the chips are down. So, yes, looking back, I don't regret it, although it's a terrible thing to say. But I do feel that people do misunderstand this when I say that.